Okay, everybody, would like to begin? On the way here, I may have made a mistake, but listening to myself speak last year, I was amazed at how fast I spoke. It was really embarrassing.
Did you want to binge yourself, though?
Yeah, that was fine. I even laughed at my jokes. It was really
Look at Joey's towel and
right.
eye.
Right.
Look at Joey's towel and eye.
Yes.
When we're smiling, it usually means it's
only fish. Okay, so I'm going to really make an attempt this evening at doing it really much slower, so we'll have to speak at least 2 extra weeks.
Where's it going?
Clutter.
Takes time for the sound waves to get there, right. Last week, we made 3 distinct points. First of all, we made the point that science and religion are now reconverging after 500 years of a very sad and bitter divorce. Scientists are using terms such as miraculous and intelligent design. Point number one. Point number two. We then covered some aspects as to what the universe is all about. In order to truly understand what we had called Dat Elohim, we needed to know what exactly are we talking about. And we spoke about the size of the universe, the age of the universe, along with the improbability of all of this actually happening. For example, we had shown from the book Symbiotic Universe that the charge between electron and proton has to be perfectly balanced. If it happens to be 1/1,000,000,000 of a billionth off, then nothing would exist, which is extraordinary. That was one of the many improbabilities which suggest intelligent design. Then Ricky came along, and he raised the question. And Ricky, of course, raised the question that, well, yes, given the universe as it is, it's improbable. However, if you have 1 billion universes in the process of formation, then in that infinite number of billion universes, you're going to have one that's going to finally work. Right? And of course, that is, interestingly enough, a claim that many will make. However, I will counter that argument by saying, of course, he has a point, certainly right, but he would have to get a PhD in statistics and in theories of improbabilities to come to that conclusion. Why do I say that? When I'm thinking about his point, I said, let's say you took 10 monkeys, put them in a room such as this for 1 year. What are the probabilities that they would type out a Shakespearean sonnet? So the answer is zero, right? It's not going to happen. Because any one dot off, you ruin the entire Shakespearean sonnet. So we're going to say to me, oh, what's 1 year, what's 10 monkeys? So I'm going to give you 1,000 monkeys in 1,000 years, right? And then would there be a probability that these monkeys, all typing, that one of them has to come up with all of, let's say, Shakespearean works? Improbable. Let's give him 1,000,000 monkeys running around, jumping around, eating bananas, which is what monkeys do, mm-hmm. right?
And writing poetry.
You know monkeys write poetry? You go to NYU, that's why I guess. That's why you think they didn't go there. Okay, so let's say you did that. 1,000,000 monkeys, unless you gave him 1,000,000 years. Is that going to happen? Even though logically, the position is well taken, that it makes sense that if you give infinite number of time, that's really going to happen, I would say to you that in theories of probability, it's not going to happen.
So then why make universes that don't work?
Who said they didn't? He said they did.
Ricky. No, that's the case. Baral said that the universes were created, they didn't work.
It says Baral Olamot Mahayrivan.
Right.
We don't know what that really means, and we're not going to pursue it right now. Well, that might mean world, it might not be literally true. That's something that one has to analyze in terms of what was the pshat of Chazal's statement in that context. So not for now. We'll come back to it later on if you prefer. So my point again to Ricky is that theories of probability are such that there might be a situation where even in an X period of time, something may not happen, even though you think that given infinite time, any of the possibilities, then that should happen. So I would go a step further and say the creation of the universe as it is so much more improbable than what you and I spoke about last week. And again, the symbiotic universe from a non-theistic person is still making the point that he can't figure out what happened, but the improbabilities are so vast, including the notion of three dimensions rather than two dimensions. Your brain would not work if it was two-dimensional, because it wouldn't be able to get over each other's synapses. Nothing would work. And if there were more than two, if there were three, or if there were four or five dimensions, also it wouldn't work. He goes to all of these scientific arguments, and it comes down to the impossibility, in quotes, of a universe as it is, so perfectly structured, that it really was one billionth of a billionth of a percentage. If electrons and protons were off and not perfectly balanced, it's gone.
So you're saying almost impossible unless God had his hand.
I don't want to use the word God. I mean, Greasy doesn't use the word God.
Not God, but what you and I are calling.
It seems to be right. It seems to be intelligent design.
Hand in the creation.
Intelligent design. Right.
Because of the improbable statistics.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, but we're going to come back to that a little bit later. But just wanted to make that point at this point. Now, let's go one step beyond that. I came interested, a question interested is also in line of this notion. There was a solar storm last week where there were particles shooting out of the sun 5 million miles an hour. So that was very impressive. However, then I read about a quasar. A quasar travels 29,625 miles per second. So I figured out how much that per hour. And it's much more. So that means that the brightest object in the universe, which is a quasar, is the fastest traveling item in the universe other than light, right? And this particular quasar was there 8 billion years ago and exploded, and we're just getting its light now 8 billion years later. So you can imagine the tremendous amount of energy to have an item that bright 8 billion years ago, and reaching us now 8 billion years later.
That's relative to distance also, no?
Yeah, it's 8 billion light years away.
Right.
So how much energy was involved in that? So that's way beyond even what our sun is capable of doing. But our sun is not capable of doing that either. So what we have over here is an extraordinary universe which seems to indicate intelligent design. Now, that was our second point about the nature of the universe. And our third point, we raised three basic questions that science raises in the face of religion. We're going to state these questions in a number of different fashions. First, let's do it very simply and then come back to a more complicated formulation of these questions. Question number one is about creation. Was there, in fact, creation? First question. Bereshit says yes. Science at one point said absolutely not. For 2,000 years, science said absolutely no creation. We'll talk about that in a bit more detail in a moment.
Is that Aristotle's point of view?
Absolutely. Good friend of mine, and that's what he said to me many, many times. Point number two, or question number two we raised was, is the universe 12.2 plus billion years or 5,764 years, as Bereshit seems to indicate. Point number three, evolution of mankind, is the biblical description of man, wherein Borei Olam takes a human being, Afar, and he fashions it, and then creates a human being. Is that the way human was created? Or was human created through some kind of evolutionary process, which is what science asserts? Right? So we have three essential questions where science seems to contradict religion. Now let's try to lay out the options that we have. First question, can religion avoid these challenges? What do you think? Can religion avoid these challenges?
Challenge number one doesn't sound like a big deal.
Is it creation or not?
Right. Aristotle had this concept of the four elements that always existed, and so we have the problem of believing that since God is unique and he unique in the sense that we can't even describe. You have to predate matter. But that we could still divide the matter was created by God at one time, and then came the creation that we know from that matter to sort of bridge the gap.
Is the matter eternal? Is your matter...
Could be not, could be yes.
What is it, what I said?
What I? Doesn't say whether it's, the earth is eternal.
Is the matter eternal?
No, no. So you
pre-existed before the creation of our world. It's possible.
Universe, universe.
Our universe is possible given the vastness of the whole thing. Maybe God pre-existed that anyway. It's not clear.
What is it, maybe God pre-existed that.
Okay, pre-existed.
Yeah, squeeze elements in these Brooklyn people. Deal with that.
You could finesse it. No,
so we have to finesse everything in some sense. My question to you is, can religion avoid these challenges? Is there something wrong with ignoring all the New York Times articles every single Tuesday, George Will articles, which I didn't share with you, thank you, Saul Towel, for providing me with it, I should have made a copy for you, it's a good thing to read. The PBS specials on string theory, should we ignore all that? The answer is, of course yes. We can, in fact, ignore all of that information, but we pay a price. We can completely close ourselves to all of these challenges. We can. As many hundreds of thousands of Jews, and about 25 or 30,000 Syrian Jews do, and ignore all science and the implications that these scientific challenges has for religion. But the price we pay is one of?
Ignorance.
Ignorance. Much more seriously than ignorance, is credibility. Credibility. What does that mean? It means that you're going to lose those people who find the gap between science and religion to be so far, so large, you're going to lose them. That is, you will lose your best and your brightest. Now, many religious teachers are willing to pay this price. They will say that, especially in our community as well, that truth is not an absolute necessarily. I'm willing to sacrifice the best and the brightest because I'm going to gain my average person. Most people are not challenged by these issues. Religion does not suffer the consequences of these scientific minutiae issues. And therefore, I'm willing to sacrifice ultimate truth in order to gain my community. A solid, serious, strong community.
How is that solid?
Yeah?
Do they really believe that they're sacrificing the best and the brightest? The best and the brightest follow that also. Some of the best and the brightest.
Do they think that they are...
To get the strong middle, I think that's our viewpoint or your viewpoint of it. I don't know if they really believe they're sacrificing the best and the brightest.
I think those rabbis who know this issue are willing to say that I'm willing to lose the best and the brightest in order to maintain a solid community. Okay, thank you.
Do they call them the best and the brightest, or do they call them apikoros or something like that?
Both are true. The really sophisticated ones call them the best and the brightest, and the...
But they think they're the best and the brightest.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you can find both. It's not important for us. You can find best. You can find both. My point is that you are going to sacrifice the best of the price, and there are those willing to pay that price and keep a community of faithful ignorant if the head of the community knows the truth but doesn't want to share the truth with his kahal.
We don't like that.
Of course there are, right? But of course there are others who say, we'll get this later on, there's not even a necessary price issue. Because there's no truth in the other side. Well, that we're going to elaborate in a few minutes. Okay? So, the issue over here is that many, many hundreds of thousands of Jews do, in fact, ignore the challenges, and yet they're willing to pay the price of losing, A, the best and the brightest, and B, of course, as you mentioned, losing the truth. They may or may not be aware of the truth, but they're willing to not even engage the truth. But let's, for a minute, go in a different direction and raise the question, is there really, thank you, we'll get to that, thank you, is there really a conflict? Certainly, superficially, or better, we could say, at first glance, there is a conflict. Here you have two disciplines, religion and science, both making opposite claims about A, the nature of the universe, and the nature of the human being. Is Torah absolutely true? We'd say absolutely yes. Is science absolutely true? We would say, with some degree of reservation, we'd say yes to that. Because science, as is well known, is a developing discipline. Its ideas about these issues are not fully formed. And therefore, of course, science should have a certain amount of intellectual modesty as he searches for truth. But still in all, given that caveat, science is still going to make certain claims that challenges the biblical statements if they're understood literally. If one is willing to not necessarily read biblical statements literally, there may not be a conflict whatsoever. So we have to explore that as well. Let's look at our issues again. Issue number one, Bereshit, creation. Science for 2,000 years spoke about a steady state universe based on Aristotle, based on observation. Their observations guided their speculations. Their observations were about a universe that was unchanging. The Big Dipper was there for the last 2,000 years, the same formulation, since nothing changed. Right? Steady state universe. 2,000 years. Issue number one. Issue number two. 7 days of creation, 12 to 14 billion years of creation. Issue number three. Science tells us that for hundreds of millions of years, dinosaurs roamed the face of the earth. Torah does not talk at all about any kind of dinosaurs. Right?
It was before the Torah.
Sorry?
Because it was before the Torah.
Who, the dinosaurs?
Yes, 60,000 years ago.
Yeah, but it talks about that period of time. Torah is given 3,000 years ago, but it talks about beginning of the universe, beginning of the Earth's universe.
It speaks of evolution.
Sorry?
It doesn't speak of, they missed that part.
That's our question. Did they miss that part or not? That's the question. Next issue. Bereshit, God fashions mankind from the dust of the earth and breathes life into the human being. Science has a very different view as to how humankind was created, evolving at some point or other from a quote-unquote ape, knowing that we share 99% of the same genetic material as the mammals. Did we evolve or not? Those are very serious issues. Peking man is 1.4 million years old, as well as Lucy, who is even older. Lucy, of course, is that prototype human being found, who is older than Peking man. Neanderthal man is 12,000 years old. All of these are questions that are raised against the biblical view of the universe and human beings. So the question is, are these two disciplines reconcilable? So the answer is, yes, we believe they are, but there is some fancy footwork that has to be engaged in order to be able to reconcile these disciplines. Let's try to explore all the possibilities before we come to our answers. First, along a spectrum of Jewish thinkers, there are those you will find that absolutely reject all speculation on this issue. They will say that science is false and that we will adhere to a literal reading of the Bible, and that eventually science will come to see the universe as 5,164 years old, and that man is a divine creation, and we will call this group rejectionists. Right? Rejectionists. Now, there is a second group, which we'll call rejectionists B, who will base their notion on the Gemara Masechet Hagigah, which says that a person that looks above or below and back or in front of him, Ra'ush lo bala olam, should not have been born. Here the rabbis are attacking the Gnostics who speculated and philosophized about these issues. And that Gemara, those rabbis are saying, we are not going to make a comment about the truth status of all of this kind of philosophy and science, but we don't want you doing it. So they are rejectionists, but they're not making a comment about the scientific validity of all of these theories. You should not engage in it. Right? Second school is the isolationist school. The isolationist school is an interesting one. They say, never the twain shall meet. Both are true as is. And we are not going to try to reconcile the claims of both of these two schools. So you will say then, how could they both be true? They will simply say, both is as they are, and we are not going to try to reconcile it.
That they contradict each other.
Yes, that's correct. Right.
So how do you...
Apparent contradictions. They're saying, we don't know enough at this point. We're going to maintain A and maintain B. That's not exactly accurate, but I'll get to that in a second. Right? So there is a school of thought where people don't feel comfortable, certainly not rejecting Torah, but even those in the science realm to say, there's a lot there, but I don't know enough, I'm not going to engage in it, I'm going to allow these two worlds to remain apart.
And both exist.
And both exist. And somehow, at some point, you're going to see what philosophers called the double truth theory, where revelation tells me and reason tells me, and they're both going to equal each other. Somehow.
But not in all
when you will know, yes, when you know enough, you will see how 12 billion equals 7 days.
One day you don't know how big it, I mean, basically on the theory that you don't, one day.
They're not even going to go into that discussion. They're going to say that there are two disciplines, both are true, and I'm not going to try to reconcile them.
That's
for one reason or another.
That's
sorry?
A form of compartmentalization.
Exactly. Excellent word. It's a very big word, but it's an excellent word. It's a form of compartmentalization. I aged by saying that word. That's exactly it. Many...
But they all intertwine. You can't...
No, they do. They do. There are many thousands of Jews who get PhDs in science and don't see it as any challenge whatsoever. Both realms exist separately.
Medical science or science?
In both.
Science.
It takes a certain kind of a mind that seeks out an integrated world view. At YU, for example, you'll find many people who will take science courses and it will never will, in fact, impact upon their learning. It's two different realms.
They get one and they go into that.
Yeah, it happens all the time. There are many friends of mine, many people at YU, that do that. Science is science and Torah is Torah, and these two are just different realms. It's a very good word. I'm going to say it again, just cool on. But it's a good word.
Say it fast.
No, then I'll never get through it. Compartmentalization. It's a great human gift of putting them on different sides of your brain, so to speak, and they don't interact.
Sounds
they
like don't. You go to a class in the morning and tell you not to do certain things about business, then you go to business and you do that. Sort of like the same idea.
Right. Do people do that very innocently?
I don't know. I'm
you may not, but other people do. Other people do. It's a gift or it's a curse, depending on what you do with it. Mm. But there are two different areas, science and religion, and these two may make opposite claims, but the person does not either realize or chooses not to see the conflict between these two disciplines. In other words, In other words, they may read an article in the Times about the universe is 12 billion years old and say, wow, how interesting. That's really fascinating. Wow, that's really something. And then they will, rabbi will tell them, the universe is 5,764 years old, I said, oh, wow, that's very interesting. That's really fascinating. And these two don't conflict in their minds. And if you said to them, one second, you can't say both those are interesting. They conflict. That's also interesting. Well, that's what they're saying. We all know people who very easily compartmentalize their religion and their science.
Which is better, saying it never existed and believe only one philosophy, or to juggle both?
Depends on the personality. This might even border on the psychology of the individual. Some people need to integrate, attack, conflict, and resolve or not resolve and juggle both. And some people need to have life, yeah.
One straight course.
Right. No, it's not only one straight course. It's two courses, and you just, when you hear that one, that's fine. This one's fine. And they never conflict. They're like parallel lines. Okay? Yeah, I'm sorry, Eddie? No, not, they just don't see it as, they don't see it. Not making a connection. Because two worlds, they exist apart. You read about Peggy, you may say, oh, that's interesting. You read about Adam Farr, that's interesting. And they don't see it as a conflict. It's not, they're not concerned with that issue.
But isn't the
one time. So,
what if you ask them how old the world is? What's their answer?
Depends where you ask them.
If you ask them while they're in school, they'll tell you.
In science, they'll say, oh, right. This is what it seems to be. What it seems to be.
They're honest.
They
want to age to the world.
Yes, but
whatever it is, there's only one.
If you press them, they just won't see that conflict. They say, science says this, religion says this, and I can live with that. It's okay. It's not an issue for them. One at a time. Yes. David?
Well, so what you just said, they could say, well, let's leave it to the specialists or the theologians. I go to work and make a living, take care of anything. It doesn't matter to my daily life. It's my life.
Yes, I'm not going to worry about it. It's not an issue.
That's interesting. Good.
Most
my job. I have time to delve into what this figure allows.
Exactly. So that's a very good answer to Alan. No, it's not my issue. It's just, that's good. It's true. I'm not going to doubt science. I'm not going to doubt religion. Both live in separate realms of their lives, and it's not my concern to try to work it. I can't do it. It's not my issue. Exactly. You phrased it very well, Sammy. What?
I think the compartment was.
Sorry.
I'd like to add the fact, or at least from my perspective, that we're really speaking two different languages, although they appear to sound the same. One is French, one is German. For instance, when we talk about these 6 days of creation, I'm sorry to say, by the way, that day that they're talking about and the day we use today may not necessarily be the same.
That's cool. That's cool. You have just bridged, integrated. That's my next school. That's the next school.
And when they talk about 12 billion, that's based on the radiation levels that we understand today, the radioactive. However, they do admit already that there were periods in time that the radioactivity was somewhat different. So it's 12 billion by that definition of radioactive half-life, it's true, and it's 6 days by this definition word, but one day we'll understand those.
That's integrationist. Okay, that's another school. That's school number three.
But as of today, they both exist correctly, because I don't have a translator yet. It's a little
good,
bit of both.
But my second school doesn't even get to that point.
Doesn't care about
that point. It takes a level.
Isn't that a lie?
No!
Then how can I say one thing's right and one thing is right? It doesn't make sense.
It's a psychological prototype.
I can understand I'm not interested in it and that's it, but I can't say it's right.
They take science courses, and they go to the Beit Midrash. And again, I know many people like this. Your husband knows many people like this. Right? Confirm?
Me?
Good. Boys, don't worry about these issues.
Yeah, of course not.
You could go and see a PBS special about string theory, and a video is like, that's interesting, it's fascinating, you're engaged in it fully.
You don't reject it.
And then we go to Torah class, and you say, that's also true.
But isn't that...
And it doesn't dawn upon them, there's no need to reconcile it. It might be...
That's a good way to get
it. It might be...
You say that I'm not interested in it, and
no, they're interested. They are interested.
They aren't interested. They're not troubled by it. It's not an issue for them. It takes a certain kind of mind, of personality, to be upset by this. In the same way, let's put it this way, same way that after we finish our class tonight, most of you are going to go home and have a cup of coffee and have a nice piece of cake and go to bed. It's not going to bother you all that much. I'm going to be troubled by this. I don't sleep at night because of these kinds of issues.
But isn't knowing...
When I have good dinner, this doesn't work.
Isn't knowing where the science, where the science ends and the religion begins, where science lacks answers and you come in with religion to a certain extent? I mean, instead of just being two things that are parallel, one has a beginning and the other one may be the continuation of it. Saying... string theory, so on and so forth, which gets into that in deeper sense. But what it is, yes, I believe in science, but there's part of science where it stops, and I can't, beyond the great brain theory, what was there before? The condensed, what is there? So there's parts that the science stops. You can't write today.
Right. Okay, good.
That's ever evolving, but where there's always that step where religion comes in and brings people to certain understanding of other things.
Okay, so that is another school.
Yeah. Is it another school?
That might be another school.
That guy, the thing that you think is parallel, is more continuation of it itself.
You're right. It's another school. It's a subset of this second school.
Okay.
But I'm trying to communicate now that there is that personality of people that will fully engage in science, fully engage in religion, one second, and that will not be a problem for life. They'll live very nicely about it. It's not an issue for them. They don't care about it.
They're sitting on the fence.
They're not even deciding. They're on the fence. They're fully engaged in both.
They don't want to correlate the two.
They don't want to correlate the two. There's no need to correlate the two for them.
Let someone else.
Yeah. Sorry?
Both sides of the reason.
Don't talk at the same time. I know that one. You spoke straight. Don't do that. Sorry?
They feel like everything's going to work out in the end. Well, that's the next group.
That's another group. They're not even at that point. They're very happily living life without fully integrating. I'm going to get to the school where integration is an immense need of that person. That's the Rambam. Integration has to happen. They can't live life or sleep at night if it's not integrated fully.
Is there a term we use to...
I use the term isolationist school. I made up these terms. You don't have to use them. But my term was isolationist school, who isolate both disciplines, do not reject the claims of either.
That's guys.
So each one has its own, and it's livable this way. Yes, sorry.
What would be an example of what we call a category?
Because that's a very good question. Right? Let me come back to that. After I finish all my schools, I have a few more schools, and we'll come back to that. And we want to try to locate the figures in each school.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah.
What did you say, like an isolationist, as you say, would be like a type A personality that's willing to go with the flow as opposed to a type B personality, which you might be because you won't be able to accept that way of thinking. Like a type A person would just say his brain, his or her brain would evolve to the point where it would just... whatever made him feel comfortable, he would accept it, as opposed to the type B would be aggressive towards finding an answer. And so really it's just
good.
The type of personality that you have.
Good. I think it borders on psychology. I think you're right.
Find the name.
Certain people will simply live harmoniously and easily, passively, with no need to integrate.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, there are others. Again, I'm not so sure that we could really classify all people as type A or type B.
Well, psychology, they do.
Okay, good. So, right. So I'm saying, but if we're talking about the Rambam, is he type B? I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
He might be right, but does border on psychology. Okay? Let's go on a bit. Okay? The next school is the integrationist school, and here there's an intense need of each of these two schools to face each other. Here you have two sources of truth. Truth cannot be self-contradictory. And they see it. Whereas in the second school of thought, they don't see the contradiction. They just don't see it. It's fine. Harmonious living. This third school of integration see it as two sources of truth that contradict each other, and they cannot both be. And they can't live with themselves. That is, that A cannot be both A and A cannot be both A and
not A.
And not A. A could be A and B. Right? That we know. But A cannot be both A and not A. Now all you big shots, who first said that?
You.
Who said that first? No. Sorry? Close. Closer. It's one of the most fundamental principles in logic. It's called the principle of identity, which means A has to be A, and A cannot be non-A, and it's Aristotle. A cannot be both A and not A. A could be A and B. My shirt could be white and have buns on it. A and B. But it cannot be both a shirt and not a shirt. Either it's a shirt or it's not a shirt. Right? That's pretty clear. I hope. I tried to put the shirt on today. It worked out well. So now, therefore, the world has to be either created or eternal. The world has to, universe has to be either 12 billion or 5 or 7 days or 5,764 years old. Man is either evolved or made by God. Can't be both. How are we going to explain this? Now, here we have a number of different schools or sub-schools, the integrationist schools. First we have, let's say, for example, Nachmanides, Ramban. Ramban says that science is true. Ramban's first comment in Bereshit is all about Yuli. What is Yuli? Yuli is the Hebraic form of Heilic matter. What is Heilic matter? Heilic matter is the eternal matter that the Greeks believed ultimately was the source of a developing universe. So Ramban's first comment, 4 or 5 pages long, is all about Heilic matter. He will not deny the science that talks about Yuli or Heilic matter. He will then say, but I have a problem with Bereshit. So he'll say to us, Koch Masad Hegid Le'amo Iyabshar. He'll quote that very famous verse from Tehillim, which means, the power of God's deeds and communicating the power of God's deeds is impossible. And what is he really saying over here? Koach ma'asav hegid la'amor. Now what's the end of that pasuk that we also know that? La'tele nachat goyim. Right? It's a verse that she quotes. It's that literally it means Koach ma'asav, the power of what he did, he told his nation to ultimately give them Israel. Give them a land. Right? Whatever the original context of Tehillim was, that's what the verse means in its original context. But Ramban takes and twists that verse to say to us, to solve this problem of science religion, Koach ma'asav higid le'amo iyashar. What does that mean?
We'll never know the answer.
We'll never know the answer. It's impossible to communicate what creation was all about.
Communicate is to understand.
Understand. Understand. So now, if that's the case, what is all that Bereshit 7 days about? It's an allegory. It's not to be understood literally true, because you cannot communicate or understand, you cannot understand or communicate what Bereshit was really all about. Which is...
A lot of people hold that philosophy, right?
Absolutely. Stephen Hawking holds that philosophy. As we'll get to. Many physicists and cosmologists will say exactly the same thing.
And sages, no? And great sages.
Absolutely. Correct. So the Ramban is saying we're going to integrate science and religion by saying that yes, we take science as true, but the Bible or biblical account, that Bereshit has to be viewed differently, and therefore there's a possibility of, and he would say, though not the possibility, but the actuality of reconciliation. Yeah.
So that's his opinion.
Absolutely. It's all opinion. Absolutely.
Opinion.
Yeah.
You want to understand it.
That we cannot understand Maaseh Bereshit. But that's a very strong stream of Jewish thinking that we can never understand Ma'aseh Bereshit. Only the mystics may. Sorry?
So they made a story out of it.
An allegory.
Right.
Right. You need to have a beginning. Children need to have a beginning, so you tell them something about beginning, and then they feel a wholeness. You can't tell somebody that the beginning is so impossible to comprehend for an average person. The philosopher understands that he cannot understand. The average person needs to understand. So we have a story which gives us a nice, comfortable beginning, but it's not what really happened. It's what the Ramban would say. And a very strong stream within Jewish thinking is that we cannot understand Ma'aseh Bereshit, how God created the universe. Right, Joe?
The concept of Yuli?
Heilig matter.
Heilig matter?
Greek, right.
Is that a concept that's accepted today?
Yes and no. Depending on what second you're talking about, actually.
The only reason why I asked that, because if it's something that's been somewhat disproven and not something that really matters anymore, then there's a flaw. Yeah,
get it? Pun, matters, matter.
Very good. Check
your narrative. Great joke. You know, God, it's a good joke. I like it.
Well, it shows that there's a major flaw in that whole ideology. Well, because sometimes science will evolve and we'll actually find that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So been working 4 or 5 pages in the beginning of...
But he's not wrong about it, because Heilig matter is primeval matter. It's the basic building block of what matter is.
Certain nebulas have that material.
Absolutely, we have that material. We may have that material. So, matter is the same.
I don't know. I'm just saying, if it was based on a science that was ultimately disproven.
Some parts of it were disproven, but certainly not that notion.
Not really.
Heilig matter or primeval matter is still, it's a different term, but it's still the original matter from which the universe ultimately evolved. So that would not be a problem for him.
The only thing that changes where it's coming from.
Sorry?
The only thing that changes that at one
point. How they view it.
Right.
Right,
where
absolutely.
Where it comes from and where it has viewed now. Today they view it differently than many years.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah.
So how can you really call Rambam an integrationist if he really doesn't believe, and he doesn't really integrate the two at all levels? He says, for it to be true, you can't believe...
Literally.
Literally. So that knocks out one level, one half of the...
No, I would say that is true integration. It's an angle, it's a leap, it's a skip, it's a jump. He's saying to integrate both. I must take, this is true, science is true, religion is certainly true, but in order to integrate it...
So if he's really integrating, he's saying, well, it works on all levels. It's working on the level of allegory, and it's working on the level of being literal.
It cannot. That cannot be. It cannot work on the level of a literal reading of Bereshit from the Ramban's point of view.
Yeah.
Right.
So then,
but I still call that integration. Integration means the opposite of isolationist. He's taking both claims seriously and attempting to bring them both together.
So there's got to be something more. There's got to be a school that says we want it to work on all levels. I'm not saying it's possible, but they got to try to rectify it.
But it is working.
Wait a second. Don't yell at him. Don't yell at him. Let me try to think what he's saying. You want to find a Jewish thinker that sees Bereshit as literally true and sees science as literally true and reconcile.
And more, and saying, well...
Forget the war yet. Let's talk about this. That, you don't find any Jewish thinker that's going to say that. Bereshit, if you're going to assert the fundamental literalness of Bereshit, then that person cannot accept the scientific claims about either mankind or the universe. Every scientist will say that the universe is 12.2 billion years old, right? And therefore you cannot accept literally Bereshit. There will be those religious who will say literally true here and literally true there, but those are the school of isolationists and don't see it as integrating.
They have to compromise somewhere along the way.
Use that word compromise. Not a compromise. It's not a compromise. It's integration. They're not compromising anything. why are you wedded to a literal understanding of Bereshit? Many narratives of the Torah are not to be understood literally, but allegorically. When the Torah tells you, in an obvious example, Arim v'galot u'psurot ad la'shamayim, that you, the Jewish people, will confront cities that are great and fortress-like all the way up to the heavens. Is that literally true? No. What was it? That's an allegorical statement that they're very powerful cities. So that's not literal. Did the snake really speak in Gan Eden? Or was that an allegory?
Was Abraham an allegory?
No.
What about
Noah?
No. You question one, why not question the whole thing?
Because reason is the object. Reason. Reason will tell you that which can be viewed as allegorical, and reason will tell you which cannot be viewed as allegorical. So allegorical owners that tell you the snake did not speak, and he could prove. I don't want to talk about it right now, but he can tell you the snake did not speak, and he'll prove to you reasonably, logically, why the snake did not speak in Gan Eden. However, there's nothing unreasonable about an Abraham living.
But the donkey did. No.
Rambam would say no, he did not. Because that's not reasonable either.
Shrek,
but no, so it's based on reason. I'm sorry?
Is that reasonable? Where do you draw the line, is my point. Is Yom Suf reasonable?
They would use reason to draw the line. And again, we don't want to pursue this right now. We don't want to pursue this right now. It's a different class, really. But maybe we'll come back to it at the end if we have a time. So, coming back to your point, there's nobody that's going to try to see the biblical narrative as literally true, as well as taking the claims of science seriously and try to integrate them, as opposed to that person who is an isolationist who will take this is literally true and this is literally true, and yet there's no problem. So that you'll find.
You're saying it can't be done.
Cannot be done. As an isolationist, it can be done, but not as an integrationist. Yeah. Miriam.
So I'm just going to suggest the Torah accommodation.
Then integration?
Yeah, because accommodating both views, having both views be acceptable, even though they're not really integrated. I mean, isn't integrated
when we... You might be right, but I believe that Ramban would say that I am integrating both. I'm harmoniously integrating both through the process of interpretation. Which is that I'm going to interpret Bereshit as non-literally. Why? Because Kof Masar Hagid La'amor Iyafshar. Because you cannot really communicate, because we don't understand, what Kof Masar is all about. Perhaps that's it. He doesn't tell us why. Let's go on. Now we have another school of thought that is slightly different than the integrationist school of the Ramban, and that is the Rambam. It's a challenge to try to figure out how do these two integrationists differ. We'll see if we can figure it out. Now the Rambam Maimonides, of course, is also an integrationist. A bit different than the Ramban. He holds the principle which the Ramban, to the best of my knowledge, never hints at or communicates. But it probably believes in it, but the Rambam says it. Quote, Shema ha'emet mimisha amara. What does that mean? The Rambam lives life by the principle of listening to the truth from whatever its source. You must follow truth. Now, it's not a earth-shaking principle. The Gemara Masechta Yomah says the same thing. Hatamosha kadosh baruch hu emet, God's seal is truth. And therefore, we pursue truth. The Rambam is he who would pursue truth to whatever and whatever it takes you. As an absolute category, the mind can know truth and you must pursue truth. Now,
that means seeking science.
Absolutely.
Deep.
Absolutely.
Keep going.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Ram does that. Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a flaw. You said the mind can know truth. We can't always know truth. Things appear to be true. Science appears to be true. Maybe we need to make concessions there.
No.
Religion,
the mind,
believe is true.
You talk about what Harvey says or what the Rambam says?
I'm talking about Rabbi Levinson says.
He's not in this equation. He's only telling what other people say. Rabbi Levinson will come in at some point. If you look between the lines. Okay, the Rambam is going to say that the mind can know truth and is obligated to pursue truth. The first work the Rambam wrote was a work called Milut HaHigayon, which means a work of logic, because in order to know truth you have to be logical, rational. So the Rambam, as a 17-year-old, says, my first step in pursuing truth is to know the difference between truth and that which is false. So I know, and I only could use my logic to tell me that which is truth and that which is false. In fact, Morei Nevuchim, part 1, chapter 1, talks about Emet Vasheker, what's true and what's false. This is a brand of philosophy called epistemology, which are theories of truth, theories of logic, and the Rambam was an expert at that, because you cannot know God if you don't know truth, and you only know truth if you know logic. He was a great rationalist. Logic meant everything. Reason meant everything. Man's mind is God's glory. And therefore, he is going to jump in fully to the scientific issue, and he's going to pursue it unto its innermost parts. Rambam, we would say, is fairly unique in this way. My difference with the Ramban is that I don't think the Ramban, Nachmanides, is as a pursuer of truth to the same degree as the Rambam. Which means the Ramban is more, in a sense, authentically Jewish, internally Jewish. He enters into the framework as a Jew. The Rambam is always has one foot in, one foot out. And of course, many critique the Rambam for his love affair with Greek philosophy. He quotes Aristotle and Morei Nevuchim as much as he quotes Moshe Rabbeinu, if not more. It's going to be more than Aristotle. So the Rambam was that kind of a mind, that kind of a perspective, that had one foot in and one foot out. One might analogize roughly, and some of you may be ruffled by this a bit, those who know the intellectual Jewish world, and I might make the point that on my spectrum, somebody such as Rabbi Soloveitchik, who pursued truth, who had an incredible mind, was he a Maimonidean or was he a Nachmanidean? Right. Because he accepts a certain framework. And as much as a Maimonidean as he was, because he loved the Rambam, still in all, he always quotes the Ramban in his biblical classes. His framework is already established. You're born into a framework, and you never challenge or question that framework. So that you never questioned his belief in God, his issues of science and religion. No, he's born into a framework, and he accepts and operates within that framework fully. It's there. Rabbi Lichtenstein, Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, on the other hand, you're not going to call him a Maimonidean at all. You're not even going to call him a Nachmanidean at all. Or yes, he is a Nachmanidean, but it's also, he's further on the spectrum of being more, from what I read of his works, more enclosed in a narrower framework. That is, Rabbi Soloveitchik has the framework, but he will read and know and appreciate other philosophies, existentialism or whatever else it may be. Wilkinson does not allow, I believe, it to fully impact upon his philosophy of Judaism. For him, Torah is a capital T and everything revolves around it. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, there are two capital T's. One is Torah, absolutely, it's a framework, but there is, at certain times, a truth that dances around it that he will incorporate. On the other hand, who is that philosopher who is willing to go deep into the depths as the Rambam, come what may? It's a lot of courage to do that.
But are you saying
you're
a lesser believer?
No, absolutely not.
I
don't like
the
difference. Oh, I gotta change it then. Hold on. I gotta change it. Who, the Rambam or myself? The Rambam. Okay, good.
What does that mean? I don't like
it. It means that he would... I'll give you an example of that in a minute. I'll go back to that, okay? I would say, for example, one of the great Jewish philosophers who passed away last week at the age of 87 is a fellow called Emil Fackenheim. fascinating personality. Emil Fackenheim is a philosopher, with the capital TH, philosopher, wrote great works in general philosophy, was in the, from Germany, was in the Holocaust concentration camps, came out, and he emerged as a Jewish philosopher. Prior to that, he was a general philosopher. Now he's a Jewish philosopher, trying to understand what it means to be a Jew in the post-Holocaust world. He was married to a Christian. Married to a Christian woman, and therefore his children were all Christian. He had a number in the 60s, a number of conferences with Irving Greenberg, with different people. And at one particular conference, it was interesting how Greenberg makes the point to Fackenheim. It's amazing how we engage in these discussions about the Holocaust and God and evil and all that, and yet my children cannot ever marry your children. This struck a very deep chord in Fackenheim's life, and he decided to convert his children. His wife's Christian, with an M.A. in Christian theology. So she's fully Christian. She's a real Fabretta Christian. She's really into Christianity. Fackenheim ultimately retires from the University of Toronto faculty, comes to Yerushalayim, and ends up spending his life as a Shemad Mitzvot person, as somebody fully committed to Torah Mitzvot, praying in a shtiebel, it was, in a little synagogue in Yerushalayim, fully committed, yet also fully married. Now, of course, one of your great questions...
He's an isolationist.
Not at all. In marriage, yes. Marriage, yes. Yes. Good point. Yes. No, I don't think so. No. No, it's actually, I don't think he is at all. He has too much, almost, I would say, too bright and too much integrity to do that. The question is, what does Hashem think of him? Which is the ultimate question. What does God think of this man? I mean, he's fully committed Jewishly, can't divorce his wife that he loves and has been with for 42 years, converted his children who are fully Orthodox today, and yet it's a very strange combination. Yet he lived a very strange life. His works are brilliant. His works are wonderful. Really outstanding. Here's a person who, because of his history, I would say, pursued truth to every degree. And religion, because he started out as a Reform rabbi, which I didn't want to tell you that before, and was a Reform rabbi, PhD philosopher, religion was not something he had to be defensive about. He didn't feel he had to protect religion at all. When you're an Orthodox thinker, you're in a box, and you have to protect that which you believe in. That's your framework. He didn't have to do that. So he's the kind of person, as I would say, come back to this in a minute, as the Rambam, who the Rambam, though fully committed as a Jew, was willing to jump in fully to the waters of any alien, in quotes, thought processes, and attack it, and feel that it's going to ultimately be harmonizable. I didn't like that word.
It's too easy.
It's an irony adverb. It's going to be harmonized, if you prefer that. Any discipline, and certainly not a compartmentalizable person. He was someone who was going to integrate fully, totally, completely, no matter what. Now your question is, how's he going to do that? There are claims that are going to contradict. How's the Rambam going to do that? Well, again, the Rambam makes his point, Shema Emet, listen to the truth from whatever its source. Whatever its source means, Greek or Islamic. The Rambam knew Greek philosophy, knew Islamic philosophy, Al-Farabi, Avicenna, were two of the great influences on the Rambam. But they're going to, since truth is one, comes from God, therefore whatever they say is going to be integratable to Judaism. He's going to do it. Right? Now, let me show you how he does it.
Did you answer a question about one footing
yet? Not yet. Here's the answer. I made 30 copies this time, because Ricky yelled at me last time.
Still halfway there.
You're right. Share. I want you to share. Half this way. Half page number one. That's page number one. Here is page number two. Share them. Pass them back. Here is page number two. Try to share them. You know, one to two or three. Page number two. Page number two. Pass them around. Yes, sir. You have 328 here? 328. Okay. Here's some more page number two. Okay. Now, which one?
We need some over there.
Anybody need more pages? Page 328. Page number two.
Yes, okay. Stand here.
You pay your tuition.
She made 1,000. There's 327, 328, 327. That's page number one. Somebody pass the barber page one. Here's more 328. Any 328?
Over here.
Here's 328. Plenty of 328. She made a lot of those.
It's a fiasco.
Here's 328.
Did she decide 328 was more important?
I don't know why she did that. Right. And 329. Last page. Now, what does the Rambam do? This is a critically, here's 329. 327. I'm going to read it very slowly. Where's Marsha? Marsha?
327.
Marsha. Here? Now, this is critically important. Let me also make the point, ladies and gentlemen, let me make the point very quickly that my distinction between the Ramban and the Rambam. We'll get it all together, don't worry. This will work out. No, 3:30. 3:27, 3:29. 3:30.
Take a break, Ron.
Don't call it out. Don't confuse me. Jay, people, let's start.
Was yours.
My distinction between my Maiz and Maimonides is, this is what, extra 3:28?
Yeah.
3:28, extras.
Wow, okay. Extras.
My distinction between Maimonides and Nachmanides is not defined well enough, nor is between Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Lichtenstein. They all may deny this kind of distinction, but it's something that I do sense. Nachmanides is not the same as Maimonides. There is a distinction that they both seem to express in their works. And Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Lichtenstein. How far are you willing to go out of the box? As opposed to, let's say, somebody like Fackenheim, who goes really out of the box. He has no box. Whatever truth is, becomes his framework. That's Fackenheim. Rabbi Soloveitchik is committed to a system. But he does dance around an other philosophy. Again, existentialism or whatever one may want to call it.
Spinoza.
Sorry?
Spinoza.
Created his own system. Absolutely. Absolutely. Very little. He's an easy person to characterize. There are many who are more difficult, but he certainly was very easy. But the Rambam certainly is obviously a beloved figure to me. It's something that I've worked a lot with, and he is my model of how a Jewish person has to think. But not for everybody. Many people should be from the rejectionist school. I'm comfortable with that. People from the isolation school, I'm comfortable with that. People from the integration, the Nachmanides school, I'm comfortable with that. And Maimonides, I'm comfortable with. I've chosen the Rambam for whatever biological, sociological, intellectual reasons. The Rambam is the person that I feel most comfortable living with. Right? Here's an example of what I mean by his one foot in, one foot out. The Rambam is not going to ever reject Judaism. On the other hand, the Rambam is willing to go to every degree to make it harmonizable to the other philosophy. One foot in, one foot out. What do I mean by that? This particular case is Greek. Right. He's willing to accept it.
Like the
okay, sorry, what time?
He did that in the Guide to the Perplexed, where he tried to harmonize Judaism with the...
That's what we are thinking about right now, correct. Yes, pursuit of truth is an absolute. And Judaism is truth also, so he's going to have to figure out how to put it all together. He's going to harmonize truth of the Greeks and truth of Judaism. He's going to stretch and strain.
Why is truth of the Greeks so important to him?
Because it was true.
Science?
Yes, that's science. Yes.
That's how you label science?
Yes.
The truth
of
the Greeks.
Yes. Philosophy, yes. Philosophy or science is the same at that period of time. Let's see how he does it. You know, chapter 25, Morei Nevuchim, part 2, it's my favorite chapter. Page 327 on the bottom. Know that our shunning the affirmation of the eternity of the world is not because of a text figuring in the Torah according to which the world has been produced in time. What does that mean? Well, I'm saying, I'm not denying eternity of the world, one of our issues, because the Torah tells me about creation. Torah tells me about creation, right? Well, I'm not denying eternity because of that text. You might tell me, if Torah says creation, then what's the answer? Creation. Period. I don't care what science says. Then you might be from the rejectionist school. But I'm saying now, I don't care what the Torah says about creation and eternity. I am not denying eternity because the Torah says creation. Why did he say that? It tells you. For the text indicating that the world has been produced in time, creation, are not more numerous than those indicating that the deity is a body. What's he saying? That the Torah describes God as corporeal and as physical. There are many more texts which describe God as physical and corporeal. And what's the Rambam going to do with those texts that describe God as physical and corporeal? He's going to
reinterpret.
He cannot live with those texts because they're false. God does not have a body. So therefore the Rambam, of necessity, has to interpret them. Now, we today, as modern people, all believe that God does not have a body. Was it always the case? No. There were Jewish thinkers who did, in fact, believe that God has a body, had a body. They had to believe that. Because, why? Because the Torah said so. It's written that way, exactly. Which, of course, brings to mind the very famous comment of the Ra'avad in the Chot Teshuvah, chapter 3, where the Rambam says, if you believe God has a body, you are a heretic and deny the world to come. And the Rabbi says, how dare you say that? There are many greater people than he who believe that God has a body based on biblical text. They're from the school that says, the Bible says it, I believe it, case closed. That God has a body.
Did the Rambam actually believe that God has a
body? No.
Not the Rambam, the Rambam.
No. There are others who say that. He does not. The Rabbi does not believe that, but there are others, Gedolim Mimenu, greater than he, who believe that God has a body, based on the biblical text, and Hamidrashim, and based on Midrashic statements, Hamashabashim et Tarosh, which confused the mind.
It seemed that he just didn't like that the Rambam said that you're a heretic if you don't...
Correct.
That's probably what he didn't like, the Rambam.
Correct. Yeah. And then there's a search for who is those rabbis that believe God has a body. They've been found. The Magen Mishnah and others found who believed God is corporeal. Not important for us. But the Rambam is saying over here that because the biblical text says it does not mean you have to believe it literally. The Torah says God has a body. Do we believe that literally? No. What do we do with those texts? We reinterpret them.
So he's using that sentence, that example to
credit
the first example?
Exactly. The text...
He's working with the framework.
Sorry?
But he is working with the framework then, because if he wasn't working with the framework, then he would just throw it out.
One second. Let me just finish this before we get to the framework issue. Okay. For the text indicating that the world has been created in time, creation, are not more numerous than those indicating that the deity is a body. Nor are the gates of figurative interpretation, allegory, nor are the gates of interpretation shut in our faces. Meaning that we can interpret. We've interpreted all of the biblical statements regarding God as a body. We've interpreted those allegorically, that God is a body, because God does not have a body. So based on truth, we reinterpreted the Torah, correct? Based on truth. And so too, I can reinterpret creation based on truth if in fact Aristotle had proven by canons of logic and truth that the world, the universe is eternal and not creation. Is that clear? Again. Rambam saying that in the same way that I have reinterpreted biblical texts regarding statements that God has a body, because God cannot have a body, because it's illogical, it's contrary to the laws of logic that God has a body. He believes God has a body. What's your name again?
David.
David believes that. He believes that for sure. And because he says it says it, I believe it, case closed.
No, the opposite.
That's what they... I'll tell you what you believe. Don't you tell what you believe. Where do you come from? So that's what David believes. We'll talk about it later. Okay. Only kidding. So David, of course, believes that. So he says it, I believe it, case closed. Rambam says, as I would say, no, logic and truth says God cannot have a body, therefore what must I do to all of those biblical verses that says God has a body? I must reinterpret them. So too, creation. Zohar Torah says clearly that God created the universe. If in fact Aristotle proves, as the great philosopher science of his time, that the universe is eternal rather than created, what am I going to do with all of those biblical statements that talk about creation? Reinterpret them. That's what he says, page 328. For the gates of interpretation are not shut in our faces. We can always reinterpret based on truth, or page 328, or impossible of access to us regardless of the creation of the world. But we could interpret them as figurative, allegorically, as we have done when denying His, God's corporeality. Perhaps this would even be much easier to do. We should be very well able to give a figurative interpretation of those texts that talk about creation. Are you with me? I'm getting nervous now. If you're all with me at this point, something's wrong. Sorry? Good. That's what everybody else should be. You're just honest about it. The Rambam is saying that any text of the Torah which contradicts a true statement, we reinterpret.
I understand that, but is he saying that God had nothing to do with the universe?
No.
Is that what he's saying?
No. He's saying that the universe is either eternal or created. So that says created. Aristotle says it's eternal. And Aristotle's proven it's eternal through logic. Therefore, what must I do to those texts that say that Torah, which says it's created, I must
reinterpret
them? If he proves it. Okay.
Explain what eternal is.
It's what every scientist believed the last 2,000 years that I'm going to come to in a few minutes. I hope.
Yes, brother.
It's
that God used the eternal matter to create the world.
Yeah.
That's what I think she was.
That God used the eternal matter to create the universe. I buy that.
Yes.
But he didn't create it. He didn't create it. He didn't create it.
That's the way it's described in the book.
Not right.
That way.
We're going to reinterpret. There's no creation. According to Aristotle, there's no creation. No Big Bang. Not Yesh Me'ayim. Yesh Me'yesh, not Yesh Me'ayim. Yesh Me'ayim means Ka'atio Ex Nihilo. Creation from nothing. That didn't happen according to Aristotle. There's eternal matter. And God, Aristotle would take God had his robes at all. Aristotle believed in God, but didn't have a robe at all. Rambam said, God had a role in shaping that matter.
Okay.
Eternal matter. Okay? Yeah.
You said earlier that Rambam was sort of neutral and open to all ideas and held no respect.
Ramban or Rambam? Rambam.
Maimonides.
Right.
And Ramban was sort of
locked in, some or more.
Beliefs of the Torah, he was willing to go for anything else as long as they didn't contradict that.
Something like that, right.
It almost seems like the Rambam is the flip side of that. He's so locked into science that he'll explore Torah if it doesn't.
Correct. That's a good distinction.
Truth through science.
Yes.
Logic.
Logic. Yeah. Right. Yeah. The Ramban is more of a mystic, and therefore has less of an appreciation for truth as an absolute. Mystics see the limitations of what we call discursive reasoning. A mystic, will see that less so. The Rambam is not a mystic at all. Where's Ricky? Ricky's not here? In about 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to talk about mysticism. I think December 8th I'm speaking. And we're going to talk about Captured by Mysticism, the case of Moses Maimonides, where the mystics do in fact claim the Rambam was a mystic.
Mm-hmm.
But that's absurd. It's not the case.
So what is prophecy?
One second.
Next week.
So you see what I'm saying? So I'm saying over here is that you're right that the Rambam, Maimonides, jumps in and he will make it work, hook or crook. Ramban, the Maimonides, as a mystic, sees the limits of reason much more so. And the Biyud Alevi even more so. But we won't get to that right now. Quickly, a second, yeah.
Who's he talking to? Because he's having a basis that people believe that God is not a body. But if they're going to believe that, why wouldn't they believe?
All over again. Okay. Who was the Rambam talking to? Talking to the person who's confused by biblical texts
and philosophy.
Right,
but if you believe that God doesn't have a body, then if you believe in this kind of
If you believe
they have to misinterpret those?
Reinterpret.
Then wouldn't you believe this anyway?
No.
Because he has that as a basis, but if you don't believe him, if you don't believe that God has a body, then you wouldn't continue to believe him.
You have a lot of hymns there. I don't know which hymn you're talking about. Okay.
I'm saying he has a basis.
Don't you see? No pronouns.
Malcolm has a basis that God has a body.
Does not have a body. Right. And therefore
so
you reinterpret.
If you didn't believe that, then...
Don't use any negatives either. If you believe...
that God has a body, then...
Right.
Wouldn't you for sure believe what I'm saying...
About creation and eternity?
They have to reinterpret
those. Yes, that's what Rambam's claim. Says, don't yell at me. Good point. Now I'm saying, don't yell at me for reinterpreting creation, because you won't accept it from me that I reinterpret God's body. So why are you yelling at me? Is what he's telling this person. Got it? Jackie?
When does something become a truth for Rambam?
When it's proven by logic.
Yes.
Absolutely.
He's written his first work on logic. He knows how to get at the truth. Logic.
You have to be a Rambam to be able to be interpreting the right way, not just
whatever. To reinterpret who? Who's him? Same disease. No pronouns here.
To reinterpret text in the right way, you will have to be somebody like a Rambam.
Anybody of right reason can interpret properly. Anybody who knows logic, who knows reason, can is obligated to interpret Torah properly. We all pursue truth. Yes, sir, David?
What's the criteria for reinterpretation?
Logic! Reason!
But it's not... Okay, so let's say somebody stands up and says that Yom Tov never happened. And they have proof, they have their own proof.
The consensus of the day.
That's the consensus of the day. It may have happened 50 years ago, 500, it may happen another.
If it's...
So then he has to reinterpret Yom Tov, right?
Historical claims are different. Historical claims are different than issues of logic.
Right.
Historical claims are different.
But Aristotle may have been wrong. In other words,
he wasn't wrong.
He may have been wrong. Well, that existence is eternal and not creation.
Universe.
The universe, right?
Is eternal.
So we don't know that he's partly wrong and partly right, right?
Aristotle?
Yeah.
Are you talking about us or talking about the Rambam?
I'm talking about him. In other words,
Aristotle, Rambam, or me?
Rambam. Where is the reinterpretation?
Okay, let me get to that.
Everything subject to reinterpretation, or is it...
Yes! Everything based on canons of reason and logic. In the same way that God cannot logically be a body, and the same way that the universe cannot have been created, and therefore I must reinterpret my Torah text, which is true. Everything is that way. Let me go on. Stop. Yes, but not go away right now. Let's just make this point over here. Get back to that. Don't worry. Okay, so now. Two causes are responsible for our not doing this or believing it and believing that the world is eternal. One of them is as follows. That the deity is not a body, right, has been proven, demonstrated in Arabic, Ulim. It's an absolute proof. Ulim. David, you with me? Ulim is absolute logical proof. In the same way, are you married? You are? Good. The same way that you cannot find a married bachelor. It's impossible. It's illogical. It cannot be. Yes, right? You can't find a married bachelor. Okay, so too, God cannot have a body. They both have the exact same logical force. That's called Ulim in Arabic. As opposed to that, the second category of logic is what we call I'tiqad in Arabic, which means inferential logic. What does that mean? Where there's smoke, there's fire. If you smell smoke now, is it necessarily a fire or maybe a fire?
Maybe
a fire. That's called inferential logic. You infer from A to B. It's not as absolute as Ulim is. Ulim is absolute.
So that's not true, according to Rambam.
No. Inferential logic could be true, but it's not absolutely true.
So
the third The third statement is called Amanat, which are statements that we make on pure belief, such as Tahiyat HaMetim. Nebu'at Moshe, Ulim or Itikad? David. No, it's not Amanat. It's Itikad. It's inferential. Because 8 million people saw Moshe speak, therefore it's inferential. It's probably true. We accept it as true, but it's not Ulim.
Yes.
But Tehiyat HaMetim, you want the Mashiach, and historical claims, that's Amanat. You believe it. The Rambam's Yudim Al-Karim in the Arabic makes this logical distinction between these three categories. Right? We on the same page so far? So now, the fact that God is not a body is elim. So too is a statement. God exists. From the Ram's point of view, is that elim or tekad or amanat? David? It is? It's elim. It's absolutely proven beyond a shadow of doubt by everybody who knows philosophy and logic that God exists. It's not faith. It's not doubt. You know that it exists. No, Aristotle of course believes in God, that God exists as a necessary truth.
God exists. Okay,
absolutely. He wasn't the God that you and I recognize. He's thought, thinking thought, is Aristotle's view of God. But he absolutely there is. Okay, good. Let's finish with one of them is as follows. That the deity is not a bottom has been proven absolutely demonstrated. From this it follows necessarily I must reinterpret that everything that in its external meaning disagrees with this demonstration must be interpreted figuratively. Right? Anything that disagrees with that which is proven as absolute truth has to be interpreted figuratively. Don't take it in its pshat, literal understanding. Interpret it figuratively. Now, question. Is it illogical for a snake to speak?
Yes. It is illogical for a snake.
Is it illogical for a donkey to speak?
Yeah.
So good. So now look in Morin Nebuchim for homework and find out how the Rambam interprets the snake and donkey speaking.
How does he interpret the
Adam and Eve?
Good question.
Rabbi, do you have to look it up to show him all the way he feels about does God have a...
Of course you have to look it up.
I don't know, I'm saying it just would sound like you would know the answer because...
You want to try me on that? You better look it up.
She has to fix it. It's a lot easier.
That's why she married him. She's a pretty smart cookie over here. Go through all the work. So we see that. Interpret figuratively... Right? That verse, which literally contradicts the truth. If there's a verse that contradicts the truth, I must reinterpret that figuratively, allegorically, non-literally. Because in its literal understanding, it contradicts the truth. Right? For it is known that such texts are of necessity fit for figurative interpretation. Figurative, allegorical, non-literal. Right? However, very important, the attorney of the world, David, has not been illumized, has not been logically proven. Aristotle did not prove it. He thinks he proved it. Aristotle did not know how to prove things logically. He made a mistake. Consequently, in this case, the text ought not be rejected, David, and figuratively interpreted in order to make prevail opinion whose contrary can be made to prevail by means of various sorts of arguments. Don't worry about what that means. That was pretty hard. What he's saying over here is that since Aristotle did not reinterpret it, he did not prove it, he did say that he was wrong, we don't have to reinterpret, and we dare not reinterpret. We only reinterpret when we know that there's something that has been proven through canons of logic. So that's the Rambam's MO. The Rambam is going to take science and see it as a means by which one can procure truth, and then if he does feel that there's truth out there, the Rambam is going to integrate that into what? Into the Torah, and Torah is going to be reinterpreted. Therefore, science is a contemporary, ongoing commentary on what Torah really is all about. So now, let's take Sonia's point a step further. Let's say the Rambam is studying evolution, and let's say the scientists have proven. Now, you have to ask the question, proven how? Elim, or tekad, or amanat? Is it an absolute proof of evolution? Is it, not proof, but is it a reasonable inference, or is it a belief that they have? First decide that. If they've proven it as an absolute, then we have to reinterpret Bereshit. If it's an artekad, then you have more or less wiggle room, call it. If it's only a belief, then I'm not going to sweat at all tonight. You go home and go to sleep.
People believe.
So I'm not forced. Now, we want to apply this to a number of our areas. Before I get to that,
do we sort of see the schools of thought that we've mentioned. There's a school of thought that's rejectionist of science. A school of thought that's an isolationist. There's a school of thought integrationist. The Ramban and the Rambam, I believe, differ. If you disagree with that, you can state it. I won't be upset about it. But I believe the Rambam and the Ramban, Mahmad and Nachmanides, do offer us two different models of integration. The Ramban is a more secure framework. He's not leaving the framework. He may talk about science, but it's not a threat to him. If it's a threat, he leaves it outside. The Rambam engages the tiger or lion of science fully and not afraid of it, he jumps in. A contemporary issue over here would not be science and religion, but rather the greatest threat to religion right now is, of course, biblical criticism. So what do we do with that? So your first question, is it true? Those who know what it is. If it's true, then I have to start really working hard at reinterpreting biblical texts. If it's not true, don't worry about it. Right? So, and I get this question all the time. Keep rising from Penn. I just studied the critical theory about Bible. In Hillel, we didn't learn it. What do I do now? Right? It happens every single year. Kids go to NYU. They study Amos. We learned it with you, but with them. What do I do now? So this happens as an ongoing. We studied in Brooklyn College. Bereshit has two chapters, A and B. They contradict each other. Teacher tells two different authors. What do I do now? So this happens every single year by one kid or another who is not an isolationist. There are kids that go to Brooklyn College or any other school, and they have the studies over here, they have the religion over here, and they never integrate. They're isolationists. They have no problem with that. I did a CAT scan last week, right? You have to see how this fits together. It's cute. And I have to see, I had a nurse, and she's, it's a real mess, CAT scan, and she's telling me she went to a Bible-based college in Oklahoma. Oh, come on, you're on this CAT scan, getting CAT scan. I said, so how do you figure out science and religion? Oh, that? I mean, you're a nurse. You studied science. You studied the human body and evolution. I don't let them ever bother me. Ah, an isolationist in the flesh.
Right.
Found one. And it was amazing, because she said, well, they teach us Bible, and we learn science, but they never converge.
That's the majority.
Never the twain shall meet.
Never the twain shall meet. Well phrased. Sorry?
Wouldn't you say the majority of the people are that way?
Absolutely. As I told you before, you don't believe me.
No, I believe you.
Oh, okay, good. Feel better.
Who are the people who reinterpret science?
No. Yes.
Who are the people who reinterpret?
Which Jewish thinkers you mean?
Right. You said Ramban. Well,
no. No.
No.
The rejectionists probably do that. We didn't get to that yet. See, one can raise the question, those who know. Let's say, sorry? Yeah, I would say that. Perhaps.
You mean the rejectionist would say
science is foolish, nonsensical?
Who is the one who would say the world is 5,000 years old and they're saying it's 12 million? Well, then God made the world and then he destroyed it, and
the flood of the Black Sea,
you know, 12 million years old. Billion years old.
Right, so they're going to take science, right, the essentially the right wing of Judaism will do that. They'll take science, it's another school, and rather than reject it, they will reinterpret it. Interpret science and say eventually it's radioactive, it's radioactive. They'll manipulate the scientific claims to make it agree. So that's a good point. One last school. The last school is a school that Ronald talks about, and that's called the Mutakalimun school. That's an Islamic school. Mutakalimun is an Islamic school that were. Mutakalimun school was a branch of. Of course, Michael knows. He studied it too before. There were two schools of the Mutazilite schools. Mutazilite schools had two schools. One was the Asharite schools, and one was the Mutakalimun schools. Mutakalimun means Hamadabirim, those who speak. The Mutakalimun school were the philosophers of Islam, and the Asharite schools were the Frumis of Islam. The Frumis of Islam were those who believed that God says to every leaf that comes down, come down. Every ant that crosses the street, cross the street. So God's involved in every single thing that happens, God's involved. They were very pious, non-free will, determinists. Everything happens for a reason. Right. That's the Asharite schools.
The Buddha Kalimun are much more sophisticated. But the Rambam hates them. In part 1, chapter 71 of the Guide, he condemns and criticizes them. Why? Because they, along the lines of Eddie's point, were those who took science when it suited their religious purposes and used it to prove religion, and therefore were not really true seekers of truth.
Opportunists.
A, religious opportunists.
Right.
Could you draw the second? Close off. What's that?
Close off. I don't know.
That's banging. Who in the modern Jewish world does that?
Making peace with it? That's what I'm saying.
Was that a good joke? That was a joke. Okay. So now, I want to end in 2 minutes. 2 minutes of your time. So, the last school of thought is one that one wants to avoid. One wants to be intellectually honest as one is intellectually modest. One wants to pursue truth to every degree, yet of course be aware that what do we really know ultimately. The insight of the Ramban, that Koch Masav Gila Mo'i Yashad, should be part and parcel of our intellectual baggage as we pursue truth. Another school of thought which accepts science as an absolute and thereby comes to the conclusion that religion is nonsensical, I think it's foolish. That's not showing appropriate intellectual modesty. Religion has a good enough track record over thousands of years with great minds for this person to come along and say that religion is nonsensical and science is an absolute. And science has a track record which has its ups and downs, has its truths and its falsehoods. So one has to have the appropriate intellectual modesty, as he has to have the appropriate intellectual arrogance, if you will, in order to pursue truth. Because that's what we really have to do. That's part of Da'at Elokim that we spoke about a few weeks ago. Da'at Elokim is a religious obligation. We must pursue knowledge of God, knowledge of the universe. But as long as it goes along with intellectual modesty as well. There's still more. Shucks. Okay, we're going to end here, and next week we are going to deal with the three problems that we raised, at least two of the three problems that we raised. Number one, is creation true or eternity true? That's the first question. And how do we reconcile that with Bereshit? That's the easy one nowadays. And number two, we'll try to talk about the age of the universe versus the age of Bereshit. And if we get to it, we'll talk about how to understand evolution and the biblical account. Thank you all for coming.